left in the United States, different Trotskyist organizations, and that we kind of were kind of reestablished from abroad, so to speak. We don't have, obviously, we trace our lineage all the way back to Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky, et cetera, like all the other organizations who consider themselves Trotskyists, but we don't have a direct lineage, organizational lineage here in the United States. For example, a conference from the IPT yesterday gave their presentation and, you know, very clear, you know, explanation of where they came out of as far as the United States is concerned. But we're having a little bit different sort of experience, and I'm going to focus largely on my own personal experience in this regard. So now, obviously, technically, because of the Voorhees Act, you've all heard of, you can't formally be members of an international organization like the IMT. But you know, I've been participating in dozens of international conferences and congresses and meetings and all this kind of stuff for 14 years, as was said. Obviously, I think a lot of people here might know already that Ted Grant is sort of the theoretical grandfather, you might say, that we trace our origins back to. He was a South African who was active first in South Africa, and then he moved in the mid-30s to London to be at the heart of world imperialism, the heart of the struggle against capitalism and so on. Some of you may have also heard of the militant tendency in Britain, which is, you know, in the recent period, probably the largest, most successful, and also the most, you know, tragic stories of Trotskyism in the world. And so there was a big split in the militant, as you know, in the early 1990s, and that left the what became the IMT with no section in the United States. There was a section in the past, but during that split, basically, the people gathered around Alan Woods and Ted Grant had to sort of pick and choose their fights on the international front, and they chose to fight for, you know, places like Italy and Spain and Pakistan and so on, and just, you know, because of their size, didn't have the resources to dedicate to much of a struggle here in the U.S. And so there's a sort of a branching off there where the Socialist Alternative, the CWI, you might know them as the Peter Taff folks from Britain. They are, you know, probably the closest then to us, at least in origins. But I personally believe that we've diverged quite far in the last 20 years or so, at least as far as theory and its application and so on in the real world. Let's see. So I, not to make this too personal, but I moved to London, England, in 1997. Late 1997. I've lived in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places. I decided to go see the world a little bit and was not political at all. I played in a band. You know, I was going to record an album and keep going on tour, and that was my future. But when I was in London, I happened upon this group that turned out to be the IMT. I bought a copy of the Communist Manifesto. I had a degree in history from a small state college in Minnesota. Had no real framework for why history happens or what it all means. Read the Communist Manifesto, and it just literally, like, you know, blew my mind. And I had been fairly political when I was younger. I actually grew up in Mexico. Even though my name is John Peterson, I was born in Mexico. My mom was Mexican. And I grew up, you know, really seeing the contradictions both in Mexico and the United States. I saw, you know, poverty in Mexico and rich people here. And then I saw rich people in Mexico and poor people here. And I started putting things together. But I didn't have a framework for any sort of struggle, and was actually very apolitical and apathetic until I read the Communist Manifesto and really, you know, blew my mind. Met Ted Grant, met Alan Woods, started reading about Marxist philosophy, was really interested in this book that they had just published called The Reason and Revolt, which is about dialectical materialism and modern science, sort of a 100th anniversary commemoration of Engels' death, updating and taking a look at some of his contributions to modern science and his application of dialectical materialism to that. I ended up joining then in 1998. I only had a few months. I was on a short-term work visa in London. So I only attended a few meetings, never wrote an article, never sold a paper, never really did anything. I had no experience whatsoever. But I did check out a bunch of different groups on the left in London. I asked Alan Woods once, I said, so how do I know, you know, this is the right group? And he said, I think you're in the right group, but, you know, go check them all out, you know. I mean, he said, go check them out. So I did, and, in 1998, the U.S. and Britain were threatening to bomb Iraq. So I went to some demonstrations and talked to different folks. And, you know, there's a variety of things about the IMT that really just attracted me to them. The one was the question of theory, the question of, you know, this book, Reason and Revolt, sort of a draft book as well on the history of philosophy that Alan Woods had written, really impressed me, you know, really, you know, outlined, you know, the development of human thought and so on. And, you know, this is 1998, of course. All my friends were saying, you know, this is a new economic paradigm and there won't be a crisis for 50 years and you're wasting your time. My friends in Britain said, you'll never find a single person in the United States that would be interested in socialism or anything like that. So why don't you just go back to playing in your band and you'll be happy. But something about it told me that you know, there's something in these ideas that compelled me to actually want to do something. And as I checked out the different organizations, obviously one of the big things that sort of differentiates the IMT is the question of the mass organizations, you know, the attitude towards the trade unions, the attitude towards the traditional political parties of the working class. And, you know, despite the many contradictions and complications of that kind of an orientation, it really, you know, connected with me this idea of how do you, you know, you can have the most perfect program in the world, the most pure, thought out thing, you know, on the planet, but how do you actually connect that with the living movement, with the working class as a whole? I was also very interested in this idea that Ted Grant had developed in the post-war period, which he called proletarian Bonapartism, which is a development of Trotsky's analysis of the Soviet Union, the regimes that emerged in Eastern Europe, and the Chinese Revolution. That really, you know, interested me as well, because obviously one of the main questions we have to answer here in the United States is, you know, what the hell was the Soviet Union and what was that and what do we, you know, how can we avoid that from happening again and so on. So this analysis, this understanding of the degeneration of the Soviet Union and then applying that, you know, in under different circumstances to different developments throughout the 20th century really attracted me as well. And then, of course, the internationalism of the IMT. I mean, it's an international organization with sections in over 20 countries, groups in probably about 40 different countries. You know, going to international meetings, you meet people from, you know, from Pakistan, from Italy, from France, from Venezuela, from all over, and you really get a much different feel for what's going on in the world. I mean, even, you know, reading articles on our website, Marxist.com, isn't the same as actually then talking to these folks in person and really exchanging experiences. So this internationalism, obviously a component part of Marxism since the beginning, really was attractive to me as well. Unfortunately, I moved back to Fargo, North Dakota. Not exactly the Petrograd of America, but I had, you know, nowhere else to go, basically. So I started setting up some websites. I helped set up Marxist.com. Which is, you know, quite, you know, we visited quite a lot these days. It used to be hosted on a server in my apartment in Fargo, North Dakota. And I set up a website called newyouth.com, which is a sort of a, with a name called Youth for International Socialism, as a way of, you know, having basically FAQs and other kind of basic theoretical stuff to get people engaged and interested. Met a handful of people. And I drove, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of miles all over the country just to meet someone in North Carolina, meet someone in West Virginia, meet someone in San Francisco, meet someone, whatever, just individuals, the ones that seemed most promising through discussion online, finally trying to meet them in person. I checked out different groups on the left in the United States. I mean, everything from the Communist Party to the Socialist Party to the various Trotskyist groups to, you know, a socialist alternative or whatever. And I honestly felt that it would be much better to start from scratch than to try and, you know, amalgam all these diverse groups. And I mean, I could see with my limited experience and knowledge that there was, you know, over the very difficult period of the last 30 years, some real bending of the stick one way and another over that period that had left things just really twisted, in my opinion, real shambles, as I think obviously folks here would understand. And that's why I thought, well, you know, the odds might seem high, but I think, you know, with the support of folks from the IMT and these ideas and my confidence in these ideas and ultimately, above all, the confidence in the working class and in the fact that the theories of Marxism aren't, you know, aren't invented, that they are taken from reality and they flow from material reality, and therefore these laws will eventually assert themselves. There will be a crisis. There will be a reaction by the working class against this. It'll be contradictory. It'll be tough and so on. But you know, like I said, there was just this magnet that just attracted me to try and actually do something. So found, you know, got the first sort of core of people, and then in 2002 we had our founding congress in a public library in St. Louis, Missouri. I think there's only two of us left from that initial meeting, and obviously we had to figure out a lot of things on the fly. We put together a paper, Socialist Appeal, came out with our first issue right at the beginning of 2002, right after September 11th. We had to figure out, work out our program, how we would apply it to the United States, work out different perspectives, documents, work out our internal structures, our democratic structures, our congresses and meetings and leadership and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, I had no experience in any of this, but I was able to consult, say, with the Italians. Well, how do you do this? Or consult with the French. How do you do this? Or the British. You know, I had this network of support, and I was, very... felt like we could do some good work with that support. The orientation, what's our general orientation in the United States? I mean, obviously in a lot of countries it's fairly clear or can be at least fairly narrowed down as to what you're going to do strategically and tactically in relation to, this or that, mass organization or this or that field of work. But in the United States, it was, completely open work in the sense that there is no mass party of labor in this country. There is no traditional mass workers party. All the sort of groups on the left were so small that it wasn't even, the idea of sort of an orientation or trying to work with people in that sense didn't really, make sense from where I was starting at this point. So, figuring that out, figuring out orientation was an important thing. And we have over the years brought a lot of people from different groups, sometimes successfully, sometimes very much not successfully. But a handful of people have come that have been involved in other organizations. But above all, it's been, new people that are, completely fresh to these ideas, people that are attracted by the idea of revolution, attracted by internationalism, attracted by different developments over the last 10 years, such as the Venezuelan Revolution, the revolutionary movements in Latin America, generally, obviously in the last couple of years, the Arab Revolution and, the Occupy movement and, the movement in Wisconsin have also brought a lot of people out of the woodwork as well, who want to learn, who want theory, they want to understand what's going on. They don't want just, complaints or whatever. They want solutions, even though, obviously, we always explain that there is no quick and easy solution to this. It's not going to be an easy, simple, linear road, but ultimately there is, I think the panel this evening will address the question of socialism or barbarism. I mean, that's really what we're looking at here. And so it's been really inspiring to me, actually, how many people all around the country have been willing to sacrifice their time, their money, their energy to try and build something that for a long time was very abstract. I mean, right now we have branches in a wide range of cities. Not every city, obviously, but several cities. We have nuclei in a bunch of different areas. We're starting to open up in the south, for example, which I think is very exciting. But it was for a long time very abstract. It was this guy, John Peterson, in North Dakota with a couple websites. I mean, it wasn't very concrete, but now it's becoming much more. We have a lot more regular meetings. We have regional meetings. We have, Marxist schools. We have congresses. We have conferences. We participate in more and more in all the different sort of activities. On the left, we've been active over the last few years in a wide range of things. I spoke earlier about the Venezuelan Revolution. We, after the attempted lockout or the bosses' lockout of the oil industry at the end of 2002. We launched a campaign called Hands Off Venezuela as a way of sort of raising, awareness and solidarity and using, this living contradictory revolution that was taking place, although obviously some people don't even believe it's a revolution, using that as an example. And it really did inspire people, brought a lot of people around us because, Russian Revolution, this might seem very old and dusty and whatever, and obviously we placed great importance on the Russian Revolution. But at the beginning, people might be like, oh, this is something going on. This guy hates George Bush. What, you know, what's happening down there? Brought a lot of people around us. Also participated in the anti-war movement. Obviously, we were very small, very little infrastructure at that time, so on a very modest level. Also, same with the immigrant workers movement. Participated very heavily in that. We have quite a lot of Latino comrades. And in the recent period, you know, again, this question of a labor party. I'm convinced that we need a labor party in this country. We need a mass political vehicle. And I think that, you know, the movement is going to emerge based out of the contradictions of capitalism. And ultimately, it's going to require political expression. And I think that we can already see in the last couple of years, just in the last 6 months even, the growing pressure within, you know, the AFL-CIO and so on, as far as you know, a movement in that direction. So we launched a couple of years ago what we call the Campaign for Mass Party of Labor. Not something that we even wanted to, frankly, at that time, given our limited resources. But it seemed like the time was coming that we had to start raising this a bit more seriously. And it's obviously allowed us to reach out to the unions much more directly. I've recruited several, you know, trade union folks who are very interested in this idea. You know, obviously, it's not going to. We're not going to create the Labor Party. We're not going to even create, frankly, a mass campaign for a Labor Party. But you know, it is an opportunity to seed these ideas out there and to connect with people on that basis. Like I said, I mean, you know, above all, the IMT, the connection has been the ideas, the experience, decades and decades of experience all around the world. You know, when it comes to trade union work in the United States, we have very, very rudimentary trade union work, basically just members of unions that are, doing their work in the unions. But in other countries, like in Italy, for example, we actually helped organize, you know, mass nationwide movements, like in the Fiat factories against the attacks of the bosses. And so we can lean on that experience, and as we have opportunities in the future to do some of that work, we'll be able to consult with these comrades to understand better how that works. So yeah, this is our 10th year anniversary. We're going to be having a Congress in the autumn. We're going to have a tour with Alan Woods, who's never actually been to the United States before, next fall or this fall. So, you know, we're very excited about that. You know, still a very small organization, still very modest roots in the working class. But I think in the last, you know, given we started 10 years ago, most of that time spent in, you know, North Dakota. And then, you know, given all the events of the last period, I think that the first few years were you know, fairly difficult. But I think that, you know, we're well on track now to start establishing ourselves as a much more definite presence in the United States, and I'm sure there's lots of questions and you know, differences of opinion, and I'd be happy to address all of those. And obviously, we have a bunch of books and booklets and stuff in the back. If anybody's interested, let me know. You can buy some of that stuff. We place a heavy emphasis on theoretical training of our comrades and education. And we spend a lot of time, you know, reading and discussing, but obviously also acting. You know, it's not just enough to analyze the world. You know, we want to actually do something about it. So, but I think the range of stuff that we have, and that isn't even everything, is an indication of the seriousness that we pay to that. So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I wanted to throw something in there, and then maybe we'll take a couple of questions, and then you can sort of respond as they come. I mean, if I... following the way that you conceived of your political work within the organization, you talked about how, you know, the laws of capitalism reveal that there will be a crisis. There is going to be a response by workers to this crisis. And so your organization, your own work in the organization, you're figuring out an orientation vis-a-vis the present in order to educate people that come to respond to this crisis. That's kind of what you were saying, meaning it seems to me that you're talking about that there is like an economic crisis, and thus like people will have a response, and insofar as like your organization is responsible to this like open potential for revolutionary politics, you will provide a specific orientation, specific like assessment of the situation. I think that's what you're saying, you know, because you talked a lot about how your work in Marxist schools and theoretical contributions of your organization, it sounds like the reason why you are involved in something like trade union struggles, etc., and the reason why you're recruiting people to your organization is to provide them with a particular perspective vis-a-vis the present. And I guess I was curious, like, what is the perspective that you're actually educating people on? But then take some from the Ben.
Yeah, I guess that maybe this is a related question, but I wanted to ask about how you relate the theory and practice of your organization, because one of the issues that for instance Platypus deals with a great deal is this problem of identifying theory and practice, treating them as kind of the same, or treating them as kind of nearly neatly translatable. That one has like a set of ideas, then give a clean kind of explanation for what to do. Normal. And so there's a way in which revolutionary practice isn't directly available to us today, and yet we have like a history of revolutionary theory and revolutionary experience that we can draw from. So I'm wondering, does your group acknowledge a kind of like problem on the practical side of the theory practice divide, and then what does that mean about the problem of theory today? Like, can one analyze the world, know the world outside of an existing practice that can change the world? I mean, if we're talking about Marxism as a theory practice, way of relating theory and practice, you know, I think that Marx says that to know the world is to change it, to change the world is to know it. There's a kind of reciprocality there. But those two things aren't the same. But if we're not changing the world today, fundamentally, to what extent are we able to know it? I mean, I guess that's maybe simple way of putting it.
How about I let you respond to that?
Sure. I mean, what is a perspective? I mean, it's I think it's pretty straightforward. Like I said, that the crisis of capitalism, capitalism is a global system. There's going to be, therefore, a global crisis, and there's going to be a global response to it. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, like I said, in 98, when I first got involved, there was no Occupy movement. There was no, mass movement in Greece. There was no, Venezuelan revolution. I mean, at least that I knew, that was, that you could see these things. And I think we've seen that, especially in the last couple of years, that there are revolution, Egyptian revolution, Tunisia, etc. I mean, I think it's clear that is coming true. Obviously, just to say, oh, there's going to be a crisis, we were right, I mean, that's obviously not far from being enough. But the fact is, as I think everyone here knows, for a long time, people said there can be no crisis, there will be no revolutionary movements, and so on. So the perspective then is that there's going to be, the austerity that they're trying to impose in Europe and other parts of the world, it's just the beginning of the beginning as far as we're concerned. I mean, this system, it's not out of malice that these folks want to cut wages and pensions and healthcare and all this kind of stuff. It's just because of the crisis of the system, they're going to have to bring this about, and there are going to be mass movements against austerity. And I think that, United States is a very contradictory place, very contradictory ideology that people have, very contradictory experience, and of course, a lot of fat, so to speak, that they can sort of live off for a little while before you have, truly mass movements. But the perspective is that is going to come at a certain point, that theory, theoretical clarity is important as far as like actual practical activity, in that sense. I'll just finish with these. I mean, I guess, I always look at things from an international perspective. And I do see that there are revolutionary movements taking place around the world. I do see that there is, a lot to be learned from, for example, from, what's been going on in Venezuela for the last 10 plus years, from what's happened in the Middle East in the recent period. I'm not trained as a theoretician or anything like that. I'm not trained as a, I don't have an academic background at all. It's all been very practical for me. And obviously I understand that, producing a pamphlet or something like that isn't changing the world. It isn't the revolution or whatever. But I think all these little things that we do in the meantime, every discussion we have, every, picket line we go, in support or whatever, these are all building blocks towards, building an organization that can help support that. Now, like I said, I believe that I don't think that the Workers' International League is somehow going to attract, mass numbers of, millions of workers are going to join our little group. We've got a great program, and we've got a red flag, and they're all going to come come around us. That's why, you know, the perspective of a Labour Party for us is so important. Even if it's a reformist Labour Party, and it will be a reformist Labour Party, and it will be bureaucratic, and it will be, I mean, but if that's where millions of workers end up going, then we've got a serious forum for discussing these kinds of ideas with people, for putting forward, you know, a socialist program. Because one of the things we always emphasize is that a Labour Party isn't a panacea, it's not enough. If a Labour Party has you know, pro-capitalist policies, you're going to end up with the kinds of policies that the British Labour Party implemented throughout the Blair years, and then that, you know, their leadership still wants to implement. So if you don't adopt a socialist program and perspective, you're going to fall prey to the inevitable laws of capitalism.
Can I ask, because actually I wanted to like note the substance of the socialist perspective, meaning when you talk about like Venezuela, you talk about the Arab Spring, you talk about the Middle East, like you're saying that what your organization provides is a particular perspective, like vis-a-vis these revolutionary moments. What is the perspective that your organization is interested in teaching people about? Like, why should we care about the Venezuelan Revolution? Why should we think that it's on the left? Like, what is it that your organization is trying to draw from these events?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think one of the big questions is, you know, what is a revolution, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of debate about what a revolution actually is. But, I mean, I think the best explanation for that is in the preface to Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. I think he sums it up very concisely when he explains that ultimately it's when the ordinary masses who are normally apolitical and not involved in politics or economics come onto the stage of history and seize their destinies into their own hands. And, I mean, if you've been to Venezuela or if you've seen even some of these movies that have been produced, I mean, it's clear that that's what happened, where, you know, the river kind of overflowed its banks and you know, millions of people literally on the streets wanting change, you know, and not just a demonstration, but year after year after year, you know, pushing, you know, one way and another on the government, and, you know, and all the contradictions that are taking place there. So, I mean, the perspective, I mean, the very clear perspective that we put forward is that we need, I mean, it's a socialist program. What does that mean? We want nationalization of the banks, the land of the states, and the big industries under democratic workers' control in order to build a planned economy, you know, internationally, ultimately. You know, and that would be, you know, a socialist revolution. But, I mean, yeah, why care? I suppose if you're on the left and you don't care about what's going on in Venezuela or Egypt, then you know, God help you, I guess, or whatever. I mean, you know, if you can't recognize, you know, masses of people coming onto the streets and, again, seizing their destinies into their own hands, then it's kind of like, you know, in Results and Prospects, where Trotsky talks about the old professor who says, you know, he's talking about Kautsky, I think, where he says, oh, it's like the old professor who lectures about revolution and socialism and everything for decades, or about the spring in the case of Trotsky's analogy, and then one day he opens up the door, the windows, and sees the spring, and it's not like he's gotten used to describing it in his stuffy room, and he says, oh, that's not the spring, you know, and he slams the door shut. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people on the left have seen that. Instead of understanding that, you know, getting involved in something like this, you know, putting resources into building a group in Venezuela is what we actually did, not just analyze it from abroad, but raise resources, send people, establish groups in Venezuela in the middle of this contradictory, difficult situation, you know, after the fact, after the rivers overflowed its banks, you know, perhaps too late, perhaps we got there too late to have a decisive influence on this. But, you know, I mean, I think that it would be, you'd be remiss if you were able to generate those kinds of resources not to do something like that, and to just be satisfied with sitting there and you know, analyzing things from afar. Mm-hmm. Now, any revolution obviously is going to potentially fail. I mean, most strikes fail. Most revolutionary movement. I mean, look at our. You know, we shouldn't be here today. You know, after the heroism of the working class over the last 150 years, but we still are, because a lot of things can go wrong and have gone wrong. Mm-hmm. But at least you have to try. And I believe that it's not trying because just for the sake of trying. I think that we actually can learn from these experiences and can actually win one of these times.
Mm-hmm. But I guess the question is what to learn from the experiences.
In the transitional program, I think Trotsky outlines it. The crisis of the proletariat is the crisis of the leadership of the working class. I mean, obviously that's it's a lot more complicated than that. How do you build that leadership? How do you connect those ideas with the masses? That's the big question, but that is, I think, the fundamental core here.
Okay, one and then two.
I have a question that is kind of a follow-up on Ben's, because I felt that it was an area that, like, you didn't totally address, which is, or maybe you did address it in a way, but I just want some clarification on how you addressed it. But what Ben had said is, for Marx, to change, to know the world is to change it is to know it. The second part of that, to change it is to know it, implies that we're going to be, I mean, of course, Marx envisioned an international revolution, right, as opposed to something happening in Venezuela or in a particular country, so it could happen certainly in one then another, or something like that, like in Russia then Germany, for instance. But to change the world is to know it really implies, I mean, we are the world, okay? The workers are, I mean, it's, for Marx, certainly that is true at like an international level. And so it implies in some ways that we're gonna change ourselves by moving towards revolution and engaging in both living in a revolution, an area where that, like a time and where that becomes possible, right? And actually, as in some subjective way, plugging ourselves into it and you know, overcoming. I mean, there's something that's a barrier to our knowledge right now of what we can do, because we're not at a certain point. I mean, I think that is, you know, and I realize you said, you know, you don't have an academic background, but you've obviously like read tons of Marx, and so you're kind of familiar, I think, with what I'm talking about here. Like, there's a certain blindness that we have to how we can engage. Like, I don't know that there's a real, you know, I mean, I don't know that we can simply take what's in Marx programmatically and say, okay, this will work, right? Because we're at a point where we're blind because of, it's basically because we're stuck in capitalism. There are things we won't see until we engage in revolutionary struggle. I mean, I think that's like related to what Dan was saying.
I mean, maybe one point of reference would be like, there's a dispute a while back in the history of American Protestantism with James Buchanan, and he says, you know, the theory is complete and all that's necessary is to implement it. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that the kind of outlook, that we have like a properly constituted theoretical outlook that's given to us by the history of Marxism, and that what we stand in need of doing today is the implementation of that? Or do we have like theoretical work that has to be done, not just in terms of like disseminating theory, but also in terms of grasping capitalism and the prospects of revolution today, theoretically?
Yeah, I'm Josh from Gabby. Obviously, we have many differences with the comments of the INT as well, and so on. I won't get into that. I want to address the Labour Party question in the U.S. I'm from Canada. We have a Labour Party in Canada, the NDP. You seem to suggest that the fight for a Labour Party in the U.S. would already automatically end in having a reformist program and being the type of party that we have in Canada or in Britain, the Labour Party, and so on. I want to know how that, or how you think that might impact the way you fight for a Labour Party in the U.S. Do you suggest that it have a revolutionary program or a reformist program? Do you point to the Labour Party in Britain as a model in some sense? I do know that, and I'm not totally up on the differences between the CWI and the IMT, although I believe that one of the split differences in the early 90s was that they wanted to leave the British Labour Party, and the IMT stayed in, and has therefore been in for more than half a century in the British Labour Party. And certainly in Canada, the fight back group, as they know in Canada, as you know, are inside the NDP, and really are, you know, left wing of the NDP. Couple questions. One, under what circumstances, well, three questions. One, under what circumstances would you ever break from the Labour Party in Britain or the NDP in Canada, and how does that inform your perspective here in the U.S.? Two, how do you see this as being an extension or similar to the kind of entry tactic that Trotsky advocated in the 1930s as a sort of short-term maneuver, the so-called French term in France and here in the U.S. as well. So that's a very, I think, a very different perspective that, that they had compared, well, certainly de facto to what the IMT has been doing. And three, this isn't a question, it's a political point. For me, I see a connection here with what I think is a very mistaken perspective in Venezuela. And the connection is tailism, that the IMT seems to want to attach itself to larger political organisms, to act as a sort of left wing, to push it to the left or what have you. It's a sort of Pavloid methodology. So I think we see that in the British Labour Party, in Canada, the NDP, and Venezuela with Chavez. And it seems to me that, and maybe you can clarify if I'm wrong, that what you're suggesting for the U.S. is a very similar perspective of building a mass reformist Labour Party so you can be the left wing of that.
Okay, that's a lot on the table.
Yes, let me see. Ran out of space on my thing here. Let's see. Well, to know the world is to change it, and to change is to know it. I mean, obviously, you know, conditions determine consciousness, right? And people are going to think and see things very differently in the middle of a revolutionary movement. I think that's what was so inspiring for people when the Occupy happened. I mean, I know people that thought, this was it. You know, I'm quitting my job, and I'm going to go down and sleep on a plaza. You know, they're very excited. I mean, it completely opened their view on things. Obviously, they're very quickly disappointed and are now looking for jobs. you know, they quit their jobs to protest unemployment, some of these folks. So obviously, you know, I think conditions and experience change people's consciousness. But, I mean, I personally don't feel, I don't know, when you say at this point we're blind. I mean, I don't feel blind, and I don't feel like we are, you know, I don't know who we is. I mean, maybe individuals feel like they can't see the way forward. But one of the things that we do, and I think a lot of other groups do too, is try and develop political perspectives for what's going to happen. You know, analyzing the economic situation, political situation, the electoral prospects for this or that country. And you know, as Trotsky said, this gives you the benefit of foresight over astonishment. You can try and, you know, figure out what the most likely things are going to be. Obviously, it's not about having a crystal ball or about making predictions that are going to be absolutely true. I mean, tons of what Trotsky predicted would happen certainly didn't happen. But if he had lived, I'm confident he would have adjusted his perspectives, you know, as he's put it, through a series of successive approximations, you can come to a, you know, never, you know, richer understanding of reality and of the world and of politics and how you can participate and intervene in it. So, you know, I think that for me, I mean, those perspectives, given the idea to, you know, again, way back in 98 when, you know, the stock market, you know, whatever, the IT boom was going on still, and somehow it still said something to me that, you know, there is going to be light at the end of the tunnel. It's not always going to be like this, and there will be a crisis, and there will be people whose perspectives and consciousness will change as a result. So, yeah, I guess I'm not really, I'm active on a daily basis, you know, with actual different struggles and so on, I don't feel completely disconnected, because I can see the seeds of future much greater movements in these smaller things. You know, I mean, an immigrant workers meeting, for example. I've been in little meetings that felt like little mini Soviets, you know. I mean, you see the embryo there of these things developing. So I don't, you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, but
well,
I don't know if you want to.
Are we in the same kind of revolutionary moment that Trotsky was in? I guess that's part of the question. Is just,
well,
like,
Trotsky,
like,
lived through a long revolutionary epoch. I mean, it's not a moment. I mean, a revolution is a process.
I'm honestly thinking of it. I'm not thinking of it as an instant. I'm using it in a different way. But
sure.
I just am wondering, I mean, things have changed. Like, there was an opening in which the world was changing being changed by the socialist workers' movement and Marxism, right? I mean, there was really, like, a possibility for an international Marxist revolution in 1970.
Yeah. I mean,
can you totally?
I know that this is the last. Yeah. Sorry, because we're running out of time, so I just want to rush the conversation. But maybe the clarification point here that Ben and Lisa, and maybe I'm curious about, is the conditions under which we exist in today, the different conditions, the different historical conditions, not only a kind of like, we still live in capitalism, obviously, but the different conditions in terms of the left that we exist in today. And how does that affect your political practice?
And
how does that?
I want to take some other questions. Because
well, actually, this
I have some more to
response.
Answer, too.
I'm sorry, Ben, it's the last response because of time. Go ahead.
Is it?
We're running out of time.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll zip through these, and then we'll maybe have a couple more minutes for some more. Yeah. What else? I don't think the theory is complete and done, and we just sort of have a blueprint already. I mean, obviously, but I do believe that the fundamentals are all basically there. I remember I once asked Ted Grant, okay, so what do I do after I read all of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Trotsky? You know, I'm very enthusiastic. I haven't done it by any means yet. But and he said, well, then you should read Trotsky, Lenin, Engels, and Marx. You know, it's all there. It's really all there. I mean, I think that, you know, we have to creatively apply it. I mean, at least the embryo of these things. And so, for example, our program, we have a Congress every couple of years. It changes every couple of years, modified slightly based on changing conditions. I mean, it's not, one size fits all. Obviously, we're also dealing with an international perspective. You can't have one size fits all. I mean, things are very different in country, neighboring countries even, the political conditions that we have to work in. On the Labour Party question, I mean, I wouldn't say that it'll automatically be a reformist party and that we want to build a reformist party. I'll say, like I said, we're not going to build a Labour Party. I mean, the unions are going to build a Labour Party, obviously with other social forces involved as well, I'm sure. But we don't want it to be that. But I don't think that you can pass through from having no mass political vehicle for the working class to automatically a mass Bolshevik party. I just don't see that happening. And therefore, we have to take things as they come. On the question, let's see, what else was it? The Labour Party in the UK, we would certainly not say, hey, look how awesome Tony Blair and Ed Miliband and these people are. It's great, you know. We need something like that. We don't advocate for a reformist party. When we discuss, for example, in the campaign for Mass Party of Labour, we participate also as members of the WIL and say, look, we think it needs to be, for the reasons I explained, it needs a socialist program. If it limits itself to reformism, it's going to adopt the same policies as the capitalist parties. When would we break from a party like the NDP or the Labour Party in Britain? I think that's one of the misconceptions. People think that we have some sort of a fetish about the Labour Party. If you read the history of British Trotskyism, I think there's a history over there, a book by Ted Grant. There's many times where he was arguing against going in the Labour Party. I mean, it wasn't the best conditions. It wasn't the best place. The question in 1991 during the split, part of it was over the Labour Party. Part of it was broadly on the question of the orientation to the to the mass parties. But it was a fact that, after the Thatcher years and after the miners' strike and after all that, I mean, there was a lot of tiredness. There wasn't much to be had anywhere. The collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, that had a big effect on people on the left as well, obviously. So it wasn't a matter of like, oh, we have to stay here. It was more like, what can we get in and what can we get out? And the group around Peter Taft, they felt that they were strong enough, they were big enough, they'd done enough, to lead different movements and so on, to stand on their own in opposition to the Labour Party. And eventually they developed, at first they weren't even saying the Labour Party is bourgeoisified or anything like that, which now, of course, they say, and I think most people probably say, it's been transformed into a bourgeois party somehow. But it's not a fetish about the Labour Party. And to be honest, the vast majority of the work in Britain I've been to one Labour Party meeting in Britain when I was there. I mean, there, and it was dead. There's nothing there. It's not like we're sitting around, you know, in a boring, dead Labour Party waiting for something to happen. We're setting up Marxist societies on campuses all across the country, setting up branches all over the country. You know, education, theory, trade union work. Inherited a lot of trade union positions from the militant and from those days, trying to maintain those, and yet obviously not being able to develop it on a mass scale as in the past, but kind of trying to hold some of those positions. Long story short, I mean, it's not about just like trying to push the Labour Party to the left. It's that that's where the working class is. I mean, if there's a mass split, one way or another from the Labour Party, we're going to go with where the radicalized workers are. And obviously it is different from the very specific tactic of entrism that Trotsky advocated, in relation to the French Socialist Party, under those particular conditions, which are very different from the conditions we have today. So I would say that it's more of this orientation as opposed to entrism, so to speak. And it's also, I mean, in my opinion, you can trace this position all the way back to Marx and the Communist Manifesto. You know, Lenin's Left-Wing Communism book, I think, makes pretty clear his position on this. And we just actually published volume 2 of Ted Grant's selected works, which focuses on the question of the mass organizations and the Labour Party and some articles on the militant and so on. So it's not, I would definitely not call it Taylorism. It's not about attaching ourselves. It has nothing to do. I know a lot has been made about the fact that Chavez himself took note of us and Alan Woods met him rumors were going around even in the Venezuelan media that Alan was his advisor and all this kind of stuff, which is just not true at all. If he was his advisor, you know, he would have not, you know, they would have, you know, he would have unleashed the working class to take over the factories and nationalize them. I mean, far from it. He's far from his advisors. It's not about attaching himself, but in these meetings of the PSUV, for example, in Venezuela, that's where ordinary young people, housewives, workers, they're fighting against the bureaucracy of the state, against the bureaucracy that has done a pretty good job now of entrenching themselves in the PSUV, fighting against the pro-capitalist elements in the state and in society generally. So it's not about attaching ourselves or pushing it to the left. It's about being there. And I think we'd be very flexible about, you know, breaking with these parties, when and if the conditions emerge. But it's not about going in and sort of trying to split a group off. It's not about going in and just waiting either. Like I said, it's just this longer-term perspective. And like I said, to me, it's just really made a lot of sense to me in the long term. As an isolated individual, how are you going to connect with the masses? And I think that's the real question. So I think those are the main questions.
Well, thank you, John. I would encourage everyone to go to lunch and continue the conversations. Lunch is happening in the 13th floor, and we will continue after that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You said that Alan Woods is going to be visiting the United States in the fall.
Yes.
And where is he going to go? New York?
Definitely New York. I don't know about Chicago. We don't have any people here.
Well, I'm from New York, so okay. I would be interested in doing some kind of public interview here.
We're gonna do a bunch of stuff in New York, actually. So
yeah,
cool. Okay, yeah, thank you.